Hello and welcome once again to The Way I See It, and my name's Vanessa Coleman. Now, unfortunately today I haven't been able to corral anyone for an interview, so I thought I would read a few articles that I've come across in the last week. The first thing I'm going to read is an article by Daniel Hannan, who is the MEP for the Conservatives, and the title of this is Look to Guernsey for a Model of a Post-EU Britain. In politics, whenever you offer a foreign example, in however narrow and limited a context, you are guaranteed to be told an unrelated fact about the country you've cited. You admire Estonia's approach to shale extraction. You can't compare us to Estonia. They've got Putin on their border. You think Singapore has got a useful system of individual healthcare accounts? Yeah, and I suppose you want to live in a semi-dictatorship. It's a mystifying effect put down. We might usefully learn from Sweden's school voucher system. Britain isn't Sweden. Cue moronic applause from the BBC audience. There are more than 40 states and territories in the European Common Market, stretching from Iceland to Turkey. Only 28 of them are in the EU. So you'd have thought that if we want to consider what Britain might do after leaving the non-EU states, especially the developed ones in Western Europe, might be a useful place to start. When you look, you can hardly help noticing that these countries are doing extraordinarily well. According to the United Nations, which measures not just GDP per head, but also literacy, longevity and the like, Norway and Switzerland are the best two places in the world to be born. Both trade freely with the EU while retaining their parliamentary sovereignty. Ah, but you can't compare us to Norway. They've got oil and fish. Well, okay, I mean, Britain has oil, and but for the wretched EU, we'd have fish, too. Still, if you really don't like Norway, what about Switzerland? It has no natural resources to speak of. Like us, the Swiss became world leaders in financial services. Maybe that's a useful parallel. Yeah, well, the Swiss took Nazi gold. I won't argue the point. I'll just offer my last-ditch attempt. If Norway and Switzerland are too exotic for you, how about Guernsey? If we can't draw a parallel even with the Channel Islands, we are truly lost to introversion. Guernsey is an English-speaking, common law, parliamentary democracy. Its currency is the pound. Its head of state is the Queen. It is, for certain purposes, in political union with the UK. Its political system resembles ours in every way, except one. Guernsey is outside the EU. The bailiwick is thus a handy guide to how we'd fare after Brexit, and I've just made a visit there to find out how it works. Essentially, Guernsey opts into the economic aspects of EU membership, but opts out of everything else. Under Protocol 3 of the UK's accession treaty, the Channel Islands are covered by the EU's trade and tariffs policies. But they are outside the common fisheries policy, outside the common agricultural policy, except for import duties on non-EU produce, and outside the common rules on justice, home affairs, foreign policy, employment law, and environmental regulation. Guernsey is part of a free movement area with the UK and Ireland, but controls its immigration policy. Indeed, startlingly to British eyes, it has an immigration policy. Its legislators vote on whom to admit, on what terms and in what numbers. They are currently, for example, debating how many Syrian refugees they might take in. they set an annual population target and issue their residence permits accordingly, mainly taking in temporary workers from Latvia and Madeira. Parliamentary sovereignty evidently suits the Gurns. Their economy has been growing steadily at around 3% a year. Their GDP per capita is one of the highest in the world. Unemployment is in the hundreds, and crime is virtually non-existent. While I was there, some vandals damaged the wing mirrors of 6 cars. The item led the local news, where it was reported in scandalized tones. I can already hear the scoffers. You can't compare us to Guernsey. It's tiny. Look, let's nail down this surprisingly common objection. Are we seriously supposed to think that small nations can thrive outside the EU, but large ones can't? It's extraordinary how quickly EU supporters switch from Britain has to be part of a bigger bloc to you can't compare us to small countries. Apparently, we're simultaneously too large and too small to prosper. Ah, but Guernsey is a tax haven. In the sense that it has low taxes, yes. And why does it have low taxes? Because it is well governed. As late as the 1980s, Guernsey had no financial services industry, and its economy rested on tomatoes and tourism. Since then, it has built up a highly successful services sector without being covered by most EU directives. That's the really key point. Like Switzerland, but unlike the UK, Guernsey is excluded from some aspects of the single market in services. But the flip side is that it doesn't have to apply idiotic Brussels rules that threaten managed funds and smaller banks. Guernsey's relationship with the EU is not perfect. Many of its business leaders and politicians told me that they felt that Britain was pressurising them to accept too many EU-inspired rules in areas from fish quotas to financial regulation. Still, at least they have the right to say no, unlike Britain, where EU law has primacy and where these rules are enacted automatically. Parliamentary supremacy should be the key to any EU renegotiation. We might not want to copy Guernsey's deal precisely. For example, our global trade links give us more incentive to be able to negotiate bilateral deals outside the common commercial policy. Still, an economics-only deal inside the market but outside the political structures is attractive. The Chief Minister of Guernsey is a hugely impressive man called Jonathan Letock, one of the last islanders to have been brought up speaking the local Norman French dialect. He studied in Paris and feels very European. But what he prizes above all is the sense of accountability intrinsic in the island's parliamentary system. People know that they're in control, he told me. If they don't like a policy, they can get it changed. Extraordinary, really, that such a thing should need saying. How diminished our own democracy has become. The second thing I'm going to read is from the Mail Online, and the heading is Cameron and Osborne quietly pay the £1.7 billion bill from Brussels, which they dismissed as totally unacceptable. I don't know if you remember, about last October when there was outrage, huffing and puffing from David Cameron. And of course, like many things, behind the scenes, things get paid and he doesn't come out and huff and puff about it. But anyway, here is what it says in the article. Britain has quietly paid in full a £1.7 billion European Union surcharge that David Cameron described as appalling. The Prime Minister said he was downright angry and said the British public would find the vast sum totally unacceptable when the EU revised membership contributions last October. But the European Commission has revealed that Britain has now paid the amount due, with two instalments on the 1st of July and the 1st of September. The EU made the massive demand after recalculating the income of member states dating back almost 20 years. After Mr. Cameron was told about the surcharge at an EU summit in Brussels, he angrily denounced it as not an acceptable sum of money. In a lectern-thumping speech, he said, "We are not going suddenly to get out our checkbook and write a check for 2 billion euros. It is not going to happen." You didn't need to have a Cluedo set to know someone has been clubbed with the lead piping in the library. The EU agreed to move the deadline for payment from last December to the beginning of this month after the general election, but it has not reduced the sum. A fortnight after the bill was revealed, Chancellor George Osborne claimed to have halved it at negotiations in Brussels. As he emerged from an ECOFIN meeting with fellow EU finance ministers, he declared Britain would pay just 850 million, telling reporters, "We have halved the bill. It's a result for Britain." However, a cross-party House of Commons Treasury Committee report published earlier this year found Mr. Osborne's claim was not supported by the facts. British contributions to the EU are subject to a rebate, which means the UK receives a proportion of the amount if it pays back a year in arrears. The rebate was famously won by Margaret Thatcher because a significant proportion of the EU's budget is spent on agricultural subsidies, and the UK has a relatively small farming sector. Treasury officials claim that Mr. Osborne had negotiated that the rebate would apply to the bill, but the Commons report said he would have known this would happen automatically. The framework set out in official EU documents does not appear to leave a great deal of room for uncertainty that the rebate would inevitably apply, the report said. This should have been clear to HM Treasury as soon as it received the revised figures for gross national income, which gave rise to the surcharge. Addressing the House of Commons days after the ECOFIN meeting, Mr. Osborne said that it was not clear that the rebate would apply to the surcharge to the extent that it did. But the committee said it found Mr. Osborne's argument unpersuasive, adding, "The specific claim to have halved the bill through negotiation is difficult to support." Britain was asked to pay more after the EU statistical body, Eurostat, reviewed the way it asked member states to calculate the size of their economy. After the Office for National Statistics provided new figures, which included a revaluation of the size and contribution of the UK's charity sector, the British economy was found to be larger than previously determined. When the revised numbers from all the countries were compiled, it was decided Britain had been underpaying towards the EU, while others had paid too much. France received £801 million, while Germany had £614 million returned. UKIP MEP Jonathan Arnott, who is a member of the European Parliament's Budget Committee, said it was unthinkable that the surcharge had been paid in full. For Cameron to label this bill as appalling and completely unacceptable, and yet pay it in full, shows the sort of politics this man is willing to deal in, he said. It is deceitful, hypocritical, and it stinks of the old politics of which people are sick. It truly is a case of the EU saying, pay up, and Cameron saying, how much? A Treasury spokesman said, the Chancellor secured a deal that halved the original surcharge to 850 million, and that's exactly what we're paying. In fact, even slightly less, as our rebate will be 0.01 billion higher than anticipated. We were clear last year that this would be paid via normal processes, and in practical terms, this would involve a number of gross payments and getting money back, including the rebate. Well, folks, I don't know about you, but really, you just can't trust Cameron and Osborne. And that's why we certainly know that Cameron definitely cannot be trusted on his so-called renegotiation of our membership of the EU. My third and final article is by Kate Hoey. And the heading is, "Here's the real reason we can't renationalise the railways." Jeremy Corbyn and Andy Burnham have both pledged to renationalise the railways. "But we can't do that while we're in the European Union," says Kate Hoey. As we approach the end of Labour's leadership contest, one of the most interesting things about the last few weeks has been the resurgence of policy ideas that many had thought Labour had confined to the rubbish bin. Take the nationalisation of the railways. When Ed Miliband was the leader of our party, efforts to put immediate renationalisation in the manifesto were thwarted. 1 year on, and both Andy Burnham and Jeremy Corbyn have promised to renationalise Britain's railway network. The debate has certainly shifted left, but could either Andy or Jeremy deliver on such a promise? I'm not so sure, as neither candidate have said how they would address the big obstacle that their promise faces, the European Union. Undoubtedly, EU law will be a huge obstacle to any renationalisation scheme, especially one that aims to do away with competition and markets. The EU is clear that its objective is opening up national freight and passenger markets to cross-border competition. Its directives and regulations have created what can only be described as a legal quagmire. The main EU law in this area was the first railway directive, which was replaced and upgraded in 2012 with a new version. This was the original law that gave the Tories the excuse they needed to introduce their privatisation agenda in the 90s. That law enshrined the role of the private sector by making it a legal requirement for independent companies to be able to apply for non-discriminatory track access on a member state's track, calling for separating of the management of railway operation and infrastructure from the provision of railway transport services, separation of accounts being compulsory and organisational or institutional separation being optional. The 2012 directive has kept that principle and goes even further and says that one of its aims is to boost competition in railway service management. It also stipulates that greater integration of the union transport sector is an essential element of the completion of the internal market. The efficiency of the railway system should be improved in order to integrate it into a competitive market. In short, this means that multiple train operating companies must be allowed to use the same track competitively. In Germany, it has resulted in the state-owned Deutsche Bahn facing more and more competition from other firms. Provisions like this mean that under Prime Minister Burnham or Prime Minister Corbyn, there would be huge legal obstacles in the way of renationalising the railways. How will any effort to block private operators be compatible with EU competition law, for example? Some claim that European rules do not dictate that railways must be fully privatised. Note the interesting use of the word fully. It's true that UK law has gone further than the EU law currently requires, but it is also true that the EU would prevent a nationalisation agenda from going as far as many would like. This is a problem that is only going to get worse with time. The EU is likely to pass even more laws in this area. Since 1991, the EU has introduced three railway packages which have imposed numerous legal requirements on the member states. A fourth package is on its way, which will further open up domestic passenger services to competition. All of these laws limit a UK government's freedom of action and will bind the hands of a future Labour government. It would be hyperbole to say that all efforts to renationalise the railways would be blocked by the EU, but it would be equally naive to dismiss the problem. The facts are simple. The EU creates real legal problems for any nationalisation agenda and will bind the hands of a future Labour government that attempts to deliver on such a manifesto policy. Honest politics demands detail. Before they can give renationalisation a green light, we need to know exactly how the candidates plan to get the EU-shaped elephant off the tracks. Well, that brings the end to the programme for today. I hope you've learned something new. I hope you have a great day, and I look forward to speaking to you next week. Take care. Bye.